Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. The format of our discussion for this week is slightly different. In the meantime, this is our second podcast produced in partnership with the universities, and our partner in this discussion is the famous Oxford University in London, where the podcast was taped. I was not in the room, and the Majlis discussion was chaired by his regular guest speaker, perhaps co-host Bruce Panier, and the discussion looked into the informal industrialization in political economy and energy politics in the context of larger question of connectivity in Central Asia. So without further ado, I will hand over the show to Bruce Panier and his guest speakers, David Lewis, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Exeter, and Simon Pirani, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Oxford.
And now we're going to move to the Majlis podcast section, portion of this. And, you know, I really encourage you to ask your questions, and the hard questions, too. We will make allowances if you want to preserve your anonymity, but I certainly want to hear your input. It's the way these things work. This is an exchange of comments, so please feel free to say anything you want. For the purposes of this, because it is connectivity, we're going to kind of stick with these big projects, but with remembering that we're talking about what the Central Asians need to do in terms of their own reforms so that they can be part of this greater connectivity that's going on around them that goes into their countries and across their countries at the moment. So keep that in mind, but we'll start out with something more general, I think, which is really these projects that go through, Belt and Road, Carrick, or some of the energy projects which are multinational at the moment, something like TAPI, something like the Chinese Turkmenistan pipeline. So, and I guess I will ask my first question then to David about this, because you had mentioned the informal structures that are also driving some of the society. Now, in terms of reforms in the country, can informal structures that are developing be used, targeted to help develop the connectivity with other rules? Do you see any way that you can focus this in the direction that it plays to the advantage of connectivity?
Yes, I think part of the problem in some of the earlier development approaches was to start with institutions and hope that the economic activity would follow after, right? Whereas in reality, in most cases, institutions are developed to reflect economic activity that's going on already within formal institutions, right? So, you know, an example might be trade with China and Kyrgyzstan, which used to be a very informal process, right? With lots of shuttle trading, people just going off to Urumqi to buy consumer goods and bringing them back. That's all changed gradually over time, and institutions have come in. You know, not to say there isn't still an informal element there, but you know, when you want to scale up to something that's more sustainable and involve international companies in that process, then, of course, you've got to start to meet particular kind of requirements and so on and so forth. So some of the connectivity we've seen is also about standard setting, right? So the Eurasian Economic Union obviously sets external tariffs, but also sets particular kind of standards for food products or agricultural goods, et cetera, et cetera. So that in itself has a kind of institutionalization process. But if that gets too far ahead of economic activity, people go back to the informal because they can't deal with, you know, too heavy and bureaucratic burden, right? So there's always that complicated tension between the two, I think. So, you know, technocrats who want to impose too much institutionalization on business tend to find that people find ways around it eventually. So it's always a creative process between the two, I think. But definitely, connectivity brings in international standards, it brings in international companies, and those are two ways in which institutionalization does happen from outside.
And Simon, to bring you in, there's a credibility factor that comes into play here all the time. Now, these countries want investment, they want to be part of bigger projects, and yet at the same time, very few of them are willing to open their books to this. Turkmenistan is, again, I hate to pick on Turkmenistan, but it's a prime example, and it's not only them. It wasn't so long ago the IMF called Tajikistan out on not reporting correct figures for when they were applying for their own loans. So there is this credibility gap. Now, what, and I know this is difficult regionally because it changes from country to country, but what sort of assurances, if I'm looking to run a project through Central Asia, what sort of assurances am I going to need that they're going, what do I want them to provide for me? to show me that this project, this pipeline, this railroad, this whatever, is worth putting money in, and that the money won't disappear?
That's an interesting question.
It obviously...
Just to bring in another thing, you were mentioning the labor disputes. Yeah. Now, this is also an issue, too. Yeah. I want to invest in an oil field in western Kazakhstan, but I've read about John Ozen. Now, what assurances can I get something that's going to make me feel more comfortable about getting involved in this?
I'll answer your question in two ways. So the first is exactly on that point. Of course, as I didn't want to disguise my sympathy, which I have actually with the labor movement, whether in Jan Arzen or anywhere else, and that may have come through when I was speaking. So obviously I would say that it's long overdue, not only in Central Asian countries, but we could think of plenty of other places for ILO standards to be applied. And the crucial thing in the Jan Arzen dispute, I think, was not the workers were not even asking anybody to kind of do it all for them. They were saying, allow us to organize independent unions, which is very much part of ILO standards, and we'll get on and do the rest. So I think that's important. And I mean, I've got to mention something which I just forgot to speak about, although I had it in my notes, which is that far from investors coming in and demanding those standards, I think when Nava Pillay, the UN head of, I can't remember the human rights body that she's the head of, went to Kazakhstan and said, look, there's got to be an independent inquiry, because 16 people were killed and 60 wounded in this shooting incident, and this is a human rights problem. It was an exception to the rule, which was that the nations from which the inward investment comes, and not only China, were completely silent. And as we later discovered from the press, our own wonderful former Prime Minister Tony Blair couldn't resist the opportunity to take consultancy work advising Kazakhstan on how to massage its PR image in the light of those events. So that's one answer to your question. I suppose the other answer is that what my research on gas markets in the region tells me is that economics rules, and that where it's logical from an economic point of view to make those investments, companies will go and make them, and where it isn't, they won't. And that, you know, to be honest, I mean, the concerns that I might have about labour or that other people might have about human rights or institutional factors and so on is a long way down the pecking order. Whether we think, sitting here in Oxford, that's how it should be, that's how it actually is. And we've seen that economic logic working time and time again. And, I mean, just to balance, if you like, the very bleak picture you've painted of Turkmenistan, we have to say that actually opening up the gas export route to China is an enormous success of Turkmenistan's foreign and economic policy. Prior to that, Turkmenistan, which, as everybody here knows, I'm sure, you know, that what's written on the tin of foreign policy is neutrality and so on and so on. But, you know, when you go to Turkmenistan, you can understand the reasons. It's a very small country which has to think about how to live amongst its big neighbours, and it was always completely dependent, because its main product is natural gas, it was completely dependent on its relationship with Russia. It exported small amounts to Iran, although there were endless arguments about the price and so on. So, I mean, opening up that export route to China was a huge success, not only of Chinese policy, which is to access these resources wherever it can, but also of Turkmen policy. And I think you're right about the economic problems that Turkmenistan has suffered from the past couple of years, largely relating to the lower price of oil, and the contracts for the gas specify a link to oil prices. So the money that's being paid has fallen. And I think the key figure to watch is the black market rate, exchange rate, which has indeed fallen disastrously. So, I mean, there are serious, serious problems. But there were many predictions made at the time of the breakdown of the exports to Russia, finally stopped in 2016, but were greatly reduced after 2009. And there were many, many predictions that, the Turkmen economy is going to collapse. And it didn't, because it had opened up this alternative route.
We'll ask if anyone has any questions before I keep going on. Okay. Yes, Cordelia, we'll start with this young lady here and move our way back.
I have two questions to Professor Pirani. What do you think, that journals in oil strike can tell us about the broader civil society development of the country, because you linked it to other protests and other formations, and you also, could you please elaborate on the link between land reform protests and journalism and how these two are connected?
Thank you. I think it, so from a labour movement point of view, I mean, what struck me, which I mentioned, was the way that this dispute became something much greater than a workplace issue and obviously embraced the whole community in Jan Arzen. And I think that was a very notable feature, which you don't see very often in labour disputes in the post-Soviet space. So I think that involvement of the wider community was really crucial. I mean, certainly, I think you also have to say that it raised enormous hopes. This was my understanding from visiting Kazakhstan around that time. It raised great hopes in Almaty or in Astana that by the labour movement asserting itself, and obviously in this absolutely crucial part of the economy, that it would open the way for civil society. And I think we also have to say that the opposite happened, and that the initial response of the authorities was very clearly and very clearly related to what happened at Jan Arzen, to curtail all sorts of freedoms, not even directly connected to the labour movement. So the clampdown on the press, the trial of some of the political opposition leaders, Vladimir Kozlov, who was I think released from jail quite recently, but you know, served quite a long sentence, and many others. And about the land reform protests, I mean, to be perfectly honest, looking from the outside, I can't tell. But I want to say that everything that I do know tells us that there is a connection. I mean, everybody in Kazakhstan clearly knew about the events at Jan Arzen. I think that's connected to the point that Bruce made about interconnections, about the internet. I think this has completely kind of transformed the way that these protest movements happen. Certainly, there's in that respect, there's much in common with China, where people also learn about labour disputes and about protest movements that are going on in other parts of China through the internet. And there's this constant battle with the authorities about what sort of access there's going to be. So I think that did make a difference. And I mean, as I understand it, again, just from following the work of journalists and so on who were present, the land reform process protest was organised over the internet very, very quickly, in a matter of hours. And that also bears similarity, I think, to the sort of protests that the people who monitor these things talk about in China.
At the back.
Okay, well, my question actually follows up from the previous one. Thank you. It is about the extent of support and solidarity the participants in the Jan Arzen strike have had after the massacre of December 2011, you know, both from labor outside of Jan Arzen, from civil society in Almaty and Astana, and from foreign journalists and labor activists, or has the state been successful in suppressing the memory? Thank you. And maybe, sorry, one more question maybe to Professor Panier. I'm just wondering, maybe you maybe speak of the journalistic coverage of Jan Arzen. I'm
sure.
Wondering, for example, how Radio Liberty covered that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that every experience that civil society goes through, which I, in answer to the previous question, underlined the negative sides of that experience. But yes, I think absolutely what you saw in the period after the events in Jan Arzen was that despite that repression that I've referred to, I mean, there was within Kazakhstan a really thorough discussion. And I mean, the quotes from Yevgeny Zhovtis are just an example that they held these events in Almaty to discuss the lessons of this, and obviously all sorts of connections were built up, and I know that the human rights people from Almaty, which is a long, long way from Jana's End, I don't think it's quite as far as Oxford from Jana's End, but it is a long, long way. Yeah. And we made a point of travelling there, and as you mentioned, there was a big concern in the Russian labour movement. There were oil workers on the North Sea in the UK were sending their greetings and support of various kinds. So I think that was all certainly happening. And in the long term, I'm optimistic about the development of civil society. In a way, when I heard about these land protests, that kind of confirmed, I suppose, in my mind that, yeah, it's not simple. There's always two sides to that story.
Concerning RFARL, it's very difficult to get to Jana's End, and which we've heard, but we do have one journalist who's gotten there several times. She was just arrested, or at least briefly detained, a couple months ago for going there. It's such a hot-button issue that the authorities don't want journalists to go out there. For someone like me, it would be impossible to get there. They would see me and not let me in. But even for local journalists, they don't want them going there and asking questions about what the situation is. There's something else we got to remember. Jana's End, when it started in 2011, was pretty much confined to the specific issue of the oil workers. But both in Kazakhstan and certainly in Kyrgyzstan, what starts over one issue gradually pulls a bunch of other issues onto it. And then it becomes a much better, the land privatization scheme in Kazakhstan in 2016 that started really had its origins in the economic problems the country was experiencing coming up to that. That was just something that sparked the fire for that. And then a lot of other things came on about, well, yes, if we're going to talk about that, then what about this other social issue, or what about these benefits that we wanted, or something like that. So this is one of the problems that the Central Asian governments really all face and need to figure out how they're going to do with it, is some problems are unavoidable. Some discontent is unavoidable, but it has a habit of drawing several different issues onto it, which means that you draw whole different sectors of society into this protest too, which is what we really saw in 2016 in Kazakhstan. There were people protesting for a great number of reasons. It was billed as a land privatization protest. But if you looked at what people were demanding out there, it changed from person to person. They all came out because there was a chance to get what they'd been hoping for all that time. And that's something that, like I said, Kyrgyzstan is no stranger to that. The revolution of 2010 supposedly started over increase in utility bills and transportation fees, but quickly several different issues got dumped on top of that. And it ended up being something much bigger than what seemed to be a very small issue at start.
I wanted to ask a question for Dr. Lewis, because you were talking about formal and informal institutions. And so we've heard comments about foreign businesses go where the money is. But then we also know that there has to be a balance between the formal and informal institutions in place and then the feedback mechanisms for things that occur and then the way that policy changes. And so you talked about how Uzbekistan, for example, has brought things online. And one of the mechanisms that they use is this civil feedback page where citizens can put their feedback online and then the government can respond to it. So if you could talk a little bit more about how these could develop into the future, perhaps not just in Uzbekistan, but as a regional thing or in other countries.
Thanks. Yes, there are these presidential virtual receptions, so-called, that you can write to and complain about your problems, and they often get fixed in response. It's kind of a virtual version of President Putin's regular phone-ins, where if you're lucky enough to get him on the other end of the line, you might get your local school reopened or social issues solved. And I think this is an interesting sort of development and is a good way of resolving one of the major problems, which is this disconnect in many countries between state and society. But it also demonstrates that institutions are not working correctly, right? So in theory, you should have these intermediate institutions that are able to channel those problems and receive feedback from this local government or sectoral ministries or the health service. In other words, you shouldn't have to bother the head of state with problems about your local plumbing to get that fixed. And so this is another, I'd say almost another informal institution, which is a way of getting around the problem of getting functioning formal institutions, which takes a long time to set up, right? And it's difficult to do. And when a new leader comes in, they want quick responses and quick changes. So this is one way to do that. And I think, to a certain extent, it seems to me has been quite successful. And you see some quite similar things in other, certainly in some East Asian societies in China. You see some element of this kind of sort of responsive regime in some ways, where lots of popular issues sort of filter up in various ways. So petition system is also there. But again, it suggests that the intermediate institutions are not working the way they should do. So that, you know, it's a shortcut, but it's not a sustainable solution, I think, in the long term, because you do need to build up state institutions and civil society institutions that can do that mediating role.
Okay, we'll make it easy on Cordelia and have her come gradually forwards. One second.
I'm just thinking there's this, perhaps the possibility, it might be theoretical. In Europe, obviously, we're in some level of late capitalism. In China, we've got some level of state-controlled communism. And these Central Asian states are in the middle. They're ex-Soviet, they're ex-communist, they're trying to become capitalist. But is there the possibility that in this process, they're able to produce a new society which doesn't have some of the issues related to this, you know, massively free market with Europe and the West, and also which isn't so the heavy surveillance in China, for example, and, you know, essentially state-controlled capitalism, however you like to say it. Do you think there's a possibility that they can build something new?
Well, obviously, in a way, every society, every state builds something new, right, within their own parameters. I think the idea that I'm not sure there's some kind of new sort of Eurasian consensus which will give another sort of blueprint to the world. I think a lot of this is trial and error, right? You're trying out different aspects of different models. Obviously in Central Asia, you know, everybody is affected by their external partners. China's model of economic development only really works in China, to be honest. But, of course, elements of that sort of state-led development, state capitalism, if you like, are clearly reflected across the region. But Russia's model as well is quite influential, which I think is rather different from China. It doesn't have quite the same competitive bottom-up element to it that China has. So, you know, the optimistic way of looking at it is to say that countries at the crossroads of different movements and in this international connectivity can take the best bits of different models. I'm not sure that's how it works in practice necessarily. But I think there is a useful creative tension between, you know, the rather, what we might call now, traditional sort of Western models that IFIs put into the region and how they are reinterpreted on the ground in different ways. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm not sure we'll see some kind of new model emerging from Central Asia, at least not yet. I think it's, you know, a lot of this is the same challenges that occur in other parts of the world, and people are learning from each other.
Thank you. So my question is also a follow-on question on the dynamics of institutional transition and the transition from the informal to the formal institutions and economy can also mean that some of the more vulnerable sections of the population get left out, whether this is in agriculture or in trade. And my question is, like, how this can be done in a more inclusive way in Central Asian context?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and one I don't entirely know the answer. I think one of the problems has been that, of course, informal institutions can also provide important welfare functions, right? Mechanisms of sharing and community support can provide ways to compensate for, you know, the various failures of, or just simply a lack of capacity on behalf of the state. And often when you try and replace those with formal institutions, they're not nearly as effective, they're not nearly as inclusive, and they're much harder to access in all sorts of ways. It becomes very bureaucratic. It's not based on sort of networks and trust anymore. And of course, it's often a problem when you have rapid urbanization as well, when, you know, people are moving from the village where you do have those informal networks that support families, and you move into a city where those are absent, but they're not yet replaced with functioning city governance that can compensate for those kind of problems. So I think that is a problem across the board. You know, one area where this does appear to be an issue is in labour migration, where, again, informal practices and institutions compensate again for the lack of often social protection and indeed physical protection sometimes of migrants in, for example, in Russia, where again you depend on these existing networks, you move to Russia perhaps with people you know along existing networks and routes, another form of connectivity, of course, and that helps to compensate for some of the often rather hostile environment that you might face in parts of the labour migration experience, right? So I think, unfortunately, the sort of formal welfare side is not kept up with the changes in society and these sort of new socioeconomic developments. And so people are developing coping mechanisms and informal institutions to try and compensate for that. But as we've seen in lots of cases, that's not always effective. You need the state and you need state capacity as well.
Hi, thank you. So while we're speaking about development of connectivity and resources, clearly, the importance of the ecological connectivity of this region seems to come to the fore. And I wonder if you have any comments regarding environmental concerns at the moment in the region and how your kind of three different perspectives kind of open up different comments on this.
All right, sure. You know, again, this is what, that's an issue that shows how different the countries are, right? You know, you try to open up a gold mine or something in Kyrgyzstan, and you are bound to get people coming out and saying no. Now, that said, the Chinese have come in and built all kinds of roads out there, too. And I used to take the road between Bishkek and Issyk-Kul all the time because, of course, Issyk-Kul is a great place, so I always want to go there every chance I get. But I never remembered avalanches all during the 90s, and even the first 5 or 6 years after the turn of the century. And now the last time I went, there was one that blocked the road when I was coming up. And then 3 days later when I was coming out, there was one that blocked the road again. You know, this is an example. All right, the road's better. It's fine. But what exactly was the trade-off for this? It wasn't just here's your new fantastic road. It was, you know, that there's all this other stuff that comes with it. So there's the development, and especially if it's development that includes an outside foreign company or foreign country. It's resisted, even in Kazakhstan, there's places I know that they have the resort area that they wanted to do. And the people there said, you know, we're not really into that. And even when they wanted the nuclear bank in Kazakhstan, which is a great idea, something that the International Atomic Energy Agency signed off on. But the people there, you know, in Kazakhstan, you have to be fair about this. This 400 and something nuclear testers. So this is obviously a nasty topic to even bring up, just like the offer to build a nuclear power plant that Putin just made when President Tokayev was out there. You know, this is something that people are going to resist because they hold the land. They've had experiences in the past, or certainly they don't want their land spoiled by these projects, which really would bring a lot of revenue in. But on the other hand, you know, it's all this revenue is only temporary, even if you're looking at it as being 4 or 5 decades. The fact is all these resources that they want are going to run out a lot of times. No, on the other hand, you have I keep picking on Turkmenistan, but Uzbekistan would be fair on this too, where the government decides that this is in the economic interest of the country, and it doesn't matter what the people think about it at all. If that means they have to be moved out, resettled, then that's the way it's going to be. Because the level of the possibility to express public discontent is far lower in these countries. So you have to be careful, although, you know, that said, this is one issue that would bring almost anybody out sooner or later. Even in Turkmenistan, where you think this stuff can't happen, there was a time not quite 20 years ago where they're to make room in Ashgabat for urban renewal plans that they had there, they had to move a whole cemetery outside 20, 30 kilometers outside of town. They didn't do a very good job of reinterring the bodies. They were very buried in shallow graves. Animals of the desert came and took away bones and things like that. And people did protest. Not many, but that was enough, you know, to get people out. So it is one of those issues that will get under people's skin and cause them to, you know, or at least give them motivation to come out and protest the action. Now, you know, it's just a question of possibility between from country to country. Sometimes you can express that opinion, and sometimes the governments are very receptive to that too. In other countries, you're taking a big risk, and they might hold off, or they might just tell you that your concerns are invalid, and they pay no attention to you, or you end up detained, jailed. Who knows? So.
Thank you.
My question is to Dr. Lewis. I want to ask, you mentioned the Latin American case of extractivist regimes, and in those cases there is not only cooperation in the financial sphere with the metropolitan countries or the countries where their financial transactions are handled or laundered, but also cooperation in the security sphere, sometimes for also internal security. Was this visible in the 2011 crisis in Kazakhstan, a type of international, or some reach out to Western countries for helping the Kazakhstan government with the 2011 crisis?
Well, again, in a room of Central Asian specialists, I stand to be corrected, but I think it's true to say that in dealing with the events in Zhanaozen, the Kazakh state, which, as I've referred to in many ways, and, well, I think we've all spoken about this, there's a continuity there with the techniques of statecraft of the Soviet Union, and I think they manage that situation, you know, very much out of their own resources. I mean, I've spoken about the assistance and support they got from outside. I mentioned former Prime Minister Tony Blair as far as their sort of international managing their international image was concerned. But I think in the actual statecraft, unlike those Latin American countries, Kazakhstan has that that machinery of state that it has taken as a legacy from the Soviet Union. So that's the answer to that question. And just very, very quickly, if I can, on the previous question about ecology, I mean, obviously in oil and gas, the big ecological question is climate change. And I think it's fair to say that the public awareness and discussion of that, I mean, certainly in Central Asia, but outside probably Europe and the States generally, is kind of fairly limited, especially in countries that are as dependent as Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan are on the exports of those commodities for their economies. That to me underlines the point about the importance of economic diversification. I mean, you could say the same thing about Russia as well, right? And that to me underlines the importance of economic diversification, which, you know, hopefully will be a topic which will be taken more seriously and which will produce some results in the region in the coming period.
Thank you. Bon appetit.
Thank you, Bruce Panier. As you all know, Bruce also runs Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Bloc, Kishlak Owazi. And huge thanks goes to Bruce Panier's guest speakers, and Dr. David Lewis, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Exeter, and Simon Pirani, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Oxford, and to the audience who helped to shape the discussion with their smart questions. And big thanks goes to Oxford University for its hospitality. All greatly appreciated. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Until next week, bye-bye.